not take the decision to kill themselves lightly. As the World Health Organization long ago noted, removing an easy and favored method of suicide was not likely to affect substantially the overall suicide rate because other methods would be chosen. Shooting is an effective method of suicide, but it is not significantly more effective than hanging, asphyxiation by car exhaust, or overdosing on pills. If guns cause suicide, then Americans should be killing themselves at much higher rates than do people in other countries, but they're not. For an industrialized nation, America has an average rate of suicide. Obviously, the more guns there are, the more suicide by gun incidents there will be, but that doesn't mean that guns increase the suicide rate. In countries where guns are less available, people simply kill themselves in other ways, often at far greater rates than we see here in the gun-filled USA. The Japanese experience debunks the notion that more guns lead to more suicide. Gun grabbers point to Japan as an example of a more peaceful, relatively gun-free nation, where gun-related homicide is almost unknown. But while the Japanese may not be shooting each other, they're spending plenty of time harming themselves. Japan's suicide rate is more than double America's. In fact, the Japanese suicide rate actually exceeds the rates of suicide and homicide in gun-crazy America combined.
ADD moment. Given all of those suicides, Japan must be a pretty terrible place to live, right? What makes it that way? Oh, I don't know. But it's not all the guns they don't have.
Of course, none of that means that guns are safe in the hands of suicidal people. They're not. And neither are pills, razors, booze bottles, ropes, hibachi grills, or the collected works of Nancy Pelosi. Yet, in a free country, we don't ban things simply because they might help you kill yourself. And remember, despite all of the arguments continually recited by all of your idiot friends, we are still a free country.
Chapter 3. Education. Reading, writing, and futility. Those of us with kids, whether on the lawn or on the horizon, have a vested interest in education. In fact, next to parenting itself, education is the largest part of the foundation upon which a child will build his or her life. Shortchange them early on, and they'll be paying the price for years. Getting pregnant at 17. Taking out an absurd mortgage at 25, tacking on 50 extra pounds by 35, and by 45, torching the house they can't afford while deep-frying a turkey for their dozen children. Most of us don't want that for our kids.
Well, kind of sounds good.
But we also innately know that the difference between our darling son decorating the front lawn with rusted-out pickup trucks on cinder blocks and presiding over a Fortune 500 company pretty much comes down to two major influential factors in his childhood: parenting and education. Parenting, well, that's up to us. We raise our sons and daughters the way we think they should be raised. We instill our values and we provide the security and nurturing environment for them to flourish. But most of all, we cross our fingers and hope we're doing the right thing. But education is different. For most of us, it's out of our hands. When the time comes, we usher our kids out from under our wings and shoo them onto a bus. We think of them learning to conjugate verbs, use correct pronouns, and assemble decent-sized sentences. We have faith that they'll be able to spell Wednesday without looking it up, and give the name of the continent they live on without having to mull it over. We hope that they'll be able to locate the state of Florida on a map, divide 9 by 3, and know which countries made up the Axis and Allies in World War II. We want these things for our children because we know that learning history, science, math, and geography can help them avoid wearing a sandwich board or dressing up as a banana. Even morons know that education is a key to success. That is how unbelievably obvious it is. Fact. We now throw 4 times more money at public schools than we did 40 years ago. Back when the government decided to increase its role in teaching our children. You'd think that that kind of capital infusion would have given us some pretty solid returns. like playgrounds buzzing with budding Einsteins, computing the trajectories of their dodgeballs. But like lots of things the government gets involved with, return on investment was really never their goal. ADD moment. Our schools are so bad that people who can barely afford their rent are willing to spend tens of thousands of dollars to put their kids into private schools. Can you imagine forking over thousands of dollars in school taxes every year and then another $30,000 to send your child to private kindergarten? People in New York City can. And they fight tooth and nail for that privilege. If that's not damning evidence that public education is rotten, I don't know what is. With very few exceptions, our public schools are costly disasters based on an antiquated tenure system and unmotivated teachers using overstuffed classrooms inside decaying buildings to pass on much of what they don't know to their undisciplined, uninterested students. Many teachers, sadly to say, wouldn't even know that that was a run-on sentence. Those students then enter the workforce or college with a subpar education that is slowly but steadily costing America her standing in the world. Nationwide, over 1 million incoming college students require remedial courses just to catch up. That is shameful. And the price tag for teaching those kids what our billions in tax dollars should have already taught them? $2.5 billion every year. That is infuriating. Is it any wonder that no one knows when the apostrophe is called for, including me? Or that plenty of people couldn't tell you when I comes before E? Why? Because they're not interested in learning that kind of stuff. They're more interested in actress-singer-whatever Jessica Simpson declaring that she thought Chicken of the Sea was chicken. Or Miss North Carolina answering a simple question by referencing U.S. Americans. Oh, we all laugh at that kind of seemingly innocuous ignorance. But is it really that funny? After all, we're the most powerful, technologically advanced nation on Earth. So why are there 32 million Americans who can't read or write? In a recent poll conducted by National Geographic, 63% of 18 to 24-year-olds could not locate Iraq on a map. 70% shrugged their shoulders when asked where Iran and Israel were. And 90% had no clue where Afghanistan was. If you're inclined to cut them some slack for not knowing their Middle East geography, chew on this. 50% couldn't even locate New York State. ADD moment. I might be willing to forgive the ignorance over Iraq-Afghanistan geography. I mean, I'm not exactly Magellan myself, except for the fact that those aren't just any countries. They're the places where our fathers, mothers, sisters, brothers have been fighting and dying for years to preserve the very system that these kids seem so uninterested in taking advantage of. Americans don't seem to agree on much anymore. But most of us, regardless of faith, economic status, or party affiliation, agree that public schools are lousy. So why can't we make the common sense decisions needed to do something about it? Simple. Because there are still lots of idiots who say things like this. Oh, come on! What's wrong with having a little government oversight of something as important as education?
Nah, I don't know. Maybe just the fact that the government has no constitutional authority to be in the education business? How does that work for you? Education is not a federal issue. It's a local and state one, which is exactly how it was treated for over 200 years. Then Jimmy Carter came along, and by the slimmest of margins, we're talking about 4 votes in the House, 1 approval to create a new ginormous government bureaucracy, the Department of Education. The creation of the DOE effectively took control from local and state governments and mom and dad and dragged it, kicking and screaming, to Washington. It also made the job of teachers' union lobbyists and special interest groups much, much easier, since they now needed to influence only one all-powerful entity rather than each individual school system. If you got your way with the DOE, you got your way with every public school in America. The only threat to the Department of Education's existence came early on when President Ronald Reagan actively lobbied to dismantle it. But politics played its part and eventually weakened the resolve of the Reaganites. While the DOE didn't grow in any great strides under Reagan, it was far from dismantled. In pushing for his America 2000 plan, think No Child Left Behind light, George H.W. Bush changed course from his predecessor, choosing to embrace the department rather than kill it. Though he didn't get too far, many Republicans at the time surprisingly still behaved like Republicans and strongly objected to expanding federal influence. He certainly contributed to the DOE's increasing growth. Bush the Elder's early departure changed nothing. Bill Clinton simply picked up the baton, tweaking America 2000 and creatively renaming it Goals 2000. By that time, federal involvement in the school system was taken for granted, so much so that by the time George W. Bush signed No Child Left Behind, which not only fed the beast, it pumped it full of growth hormone and steroids. Most Americans were completely anesthetized to the idea of national politicians being in charge of their kids' education. Early on, many politicians knew that government would be bad for education and were opposed to a larger federal role. But as soon as it actually happened, the old, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em mentality took over, and politicians abandoned common sense in favor of trying to figure out how to get a piece of the action. Remember the economic stimulus bill? Plenty of politicians were vehemently opposed to it. But as soon as it became a certainty, they stopped fighting it and started figuring out how to parlay its billions into re-election.
ADD moment. Do you remember Frank Serpico? He was the New York cop that stood up to the institutional corruption in the NYPD. He was ostracized and shot in the face for it, but he stood his ground. In the end, he won. And NYPD corruption was dealt a death blow. Serpico, by the way, wound up being portrayed by Al Pacino in a great movie that bore his name. Boy, could we use some Serpicos on Capitol Hill.
But aside from thinking that centralized planning, which didn't work so well for the Soviet Union, could fix our schools, there's another reason to keep education out of the hands of elected officials. Power. Or, more accurately, abuse of it. Schools are a direct conduit to the developing brains of our children. Radical Islamists know this, which is why they use textbooks to demonize Jews and Western values. Is there any better way to indoctrinate a generation than by starting on them when they're young and vulnerable? It should come as no surprise that a revolutionary like President Obama's pal, William Ayers, is a professor. In a speech he gave alongside Venezuelan dictator Hugo Chavez in 2006, Ayers declared that education is the motor force of revolution. He makes no apologies for the fact that he sees his classroom as the perfect environment to indoctrinate students with his anti-American, anti-capitalist worldview. If you're trying to foment a revolution from the inside, there's no better place to do it than from in front of the blackboard. Having the government plugged into the compulsory education of our children is a bad idea because it opens the door for them to promote an agenda, i.e. the founding fathers were evil old white men, Christopher Columbus was a genocidal brute, Fidel Castro is a visionary, corporations bad, government good, Mexico was just minding its own business until America came along, and the Soviet Union was simply misunderstood. Embrace certain viewpoints while censoring others and adopt standards dictated by desk jockeys in Washington, D.C. It also gives a single entity the power to determine what our children learn and by what methods they learn it. Then again, that's exactly what supporters of federally controlled education want. After all, how can progressive education creep its way into the school system on a national scale without national control of the school system?
Wait a minute. What's wrong with progressive education? Progress is good.
Education is about learning. Learning, like weight loss, is sometimes hard. You have to stay committed and push yourself day after day to see results. Don't ever say this in front of a progressive. Don't worry, none of them are listening to this book. But some people are better learners than others because some people are smarter than others. Of course, the progressive education movement doesn't like that. It's biased or unfair or something. I forget the actual claim. So they want to make education warmer, friendlier, happier. They believe the educational environment should be nurturing and comforting, not discouraging. That's why using red pens to correct tests is out, Red is harsh, and purple, soothing, is in. Progressive education also attempts to level the playing field, which, if I may translate from Progressivian to common sense, means lowering the standards. In this feel-good, sunshine and lollipops world, everyone's work goes up on the walls because it's all so wonderful. You see, it's not fair to judge a child's work because there are no wrong answers, only life experiences. Progressive education began with the goal of providing a nurturing environment that aimed at a kid's heart rather than their heads. The movement's leader, John Dewey, was a champion of education reform and believed the whole teachers teach student facts concept was so 19th century. He saw the role of the teacher as more of a coach and the role of the state as necessary to bring about the improvements progressives sought. What does that mean as far as how our kids are actually taught in the classroom? Dewey didn't try to hide his beliefs.
Existing life is so complex that the child cannot be brought into contact with it without either confusion or distraction. He is either overwhelmed by a multiplicity of activities which are going on so that he loses his own power of orderly reaction, or he is so stimulated by these various activities that his powers are permanently called into play and he becomes either unduly specialized or else disintegrated.
It gets even better.
I believe that the teacher's place and work in school is to be interpreted from the same basis. The teacher is not in the school to impose certain ideas or to form certain habits in the child, but is there as a member of the community to select the influences which shall affect the child and to assist him in properly responding to these influences.
In other words, teachers aren't there to tell a child if he is right or wrong, especially not in red ink. They're there to help the child through a touchy-feely period of self-awareness and discovery. The progressive methodology also emphasizes empathy over narrative. Rather than learning the cold hard facts about historical events, it's more important how those events make you feel. Competition is viewed as unhealthy. Grades are hurtful. Freedom is valued over structure, which means students get to do what they want rather than have to suffer through boring lessons like how to add two numbers together. And while it no doubt makes school more fun, you have to wonder if it bears any responsibility for the fact that there are students who can look at a map of the United States and go, "What's that?" The progressive movement has infiltrated both public and private schools in varying degrees. And not just here. One education secretary in the United Kingdom decried progressive education as a misplaced ideology that has let down generations of children. He's right, but plenty of schools nevertheless pride themselves on their progressive credentials. In their printed marketing materials, Manhattan's Little Red Schoolhouse says its program continues to reflect and build upon this tradition of progressive education that emphasizes individual achievement and collective responsibility. Likewise, the Teddy McArdle Free School in New Jersey describes itself as learner-centered, which is a nice way of saying that the students act as teachers. Even if they're 7 years old. The school has no classes, no curriculum, no homework, and presumably no future rocket scientists graduating from there either. The left's influence on education also continues well beyond high school. In the least shocking revelation included in this book, one study concluded that right-leaning college professors are majorly outgunned on college campuses and have to work harder to get the same jobs as their liberal peers. But the prevalence of activist and politically oriented professors has another side effect. Course offerings like The Phallus and Native American Feminisms. And we wonder why our college grads don't seem to know so much.
If we would only put as much money into the country's schools as we do its defense, everything would just be fine, Mr. Hatemonger.
We're all familiar with the bumper stickers pining for the day that the defense budget goes to the schools and the Pentagon has to hold a bake sale. But comparing educational spending with national defense isn't particularly fair, clever, or logical. First of all, we have to spend money on defense because if we don't defend our country, well, the schools won't matter much. Take the Republic of Georgia, for instance. Do you really think citizens there are worried about standardized test scores or drunk Russian soldiers driving tanks down their streets? Giving money to the school system is like giving money to a bum on the street. It might briefly feel rewarding, but deep down, you know they're not going to spend it wisely because they never have. In the case of the bum, your dollar is likely going to support some global distillery, while in the case of our schools, your dollar is going to support some politician's agenda. Schools now enjoy 4 times more money per student than they did in the 1960s. Have they gotten 4 times better? No, they have not. Have math and reading skills improved? No, they have not. Have graduation rates improved? No, they have not. Do you think throwing even more money at the problem will improve all of that? No, it will not. Though the teachers' union will probably send you a Christmas card. The U.S. Census Bureau reports that we spent an average of $9,138 per public school student in 2005-2006. Other estimates claim the real number is actually at least double that amount. Either way, that's some serious money, and we should demand some serious results, but we're not getting them. Consider the test scores of 2 states. New York, which spends the most per student of any state in the country, $14,884, and Utah, which spends the least, $5,437. New York slightly beats Utah in grade 4 reading and grade 8 reading and math, but Utah, despite spending nearly $9,500 less per student, still scores above the U.S. average in all 4 categories. If it was about the money, then places like New York and New Jersey, the 2 highest spending states, should have test scores well above those of students in Utah and Idaho, the 2 lowest spending states. But they don't. Why? Because it's not that schools don't have enough money. It's that they're forced by politicians, lobbyists, and special interests to spend it in ways that don't further their primary goals.
ADD moment. I wonder how many of our illustrious political figures have their darling progeny in, gasp, private schools. And if they do, I'd love to know why. Maybe banning the children of politicians from attending private school would be a good first step, you know, towards making sure the public ones get a teeny bit more attention.
It's worth mentioning that our Constitution makes absolutely no reference to schools or education because the federal government was never supposed to be in the education business in the first place. The 10th Amendment, the powers not delegated to the states by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people, makes that pretty clear. Of course, we don't really let a little thing like constitutionality stand in the way of expanding the central government's powers anymore.
So what's your solution? Vouchers? That'll take money away from public schools.
I assume you mean that vouchers will take money away from the schools that parents don't want to send their kids to. If a parent doesn't want his or her child to go to a school, it's usually because that school is bad, or dangerous, or possibly both. Do you blame that parent for wanting a better education for his or her child? Or isn't that exactly the kind of parents we want more of? The best argument the anti-voucher crowd can ever come up with is that vouchers will make parents want to send their children to a better school. Well, yeah. And what's wrong with that?
ADD moment. 35% of Democrats in Congress send their kids to private school. Anybody want to make a bet that at least some of the members of that group also oppose vouchers?
In normal life, we patronize businesses we like and we avoid the ones we don't. If we prefer Harry's Burger Joint to Tina's Diner, we go to Harry's, even if it's not as close or convenient as Tina's. Maybe Tina starts to realize that she's losing business because her diner is dirty or overcrowded, so she changes her menu, improves the quality of her food, fires the bad waiters, and lowers her prices. The point is that you vote with your wallet and businesses compete for that vote. That's how this whole free market capitalism thing is supposed to work. The best succeed, the worst fail. But the educational system does not operate in that normal world. It's a government monopoly that lives in a bizarro world where fair and free choice is forbidden. If you live in Zone X, which, ironically, you presumably chose to live in because that house had a better mix of features, location, and price than its competitors, then your child must attend the Zone X school, even if it's terrible, or up and coming, which means not as terrible as it was, but still terrible. Imagine if we used that same system for things other than schools, like food. What if the government forcibly took a chunk of your money in the form of a dining out tax, but then dictated that you could eat only at Lucky Fang Chinese restaurant because that's the restaurant you're zoned for? I assume you'd be pretty unhappy about that, right? Well, too bad. If you don't like Chinese food, move. But vouchers change the whole equation. They attach dollars to your child and make your child valuable to a school instead of the other way around. With vouchers, the tax dollars you're coughing up can be spent on a school you're actually excited about. What a novel idea. When parents are given the option to move their kids from public schools to charter schools, they line up in droves. Why? Because they know that charter schools have accountability for their results. Take the Thurgood Marshall Academy, TMA. A charter school located in Washington, D.C.'s infamous Ward 8. Why is it infamous? Because Ward 8 is home to 30% of the city's homicides. Because Ward 8 is home to the lowest average income in the city, $14,000 a year. And because Ward 8 has the lowest high school graduation rate in a city full of breathtakingly low graduation rates. But the Thurgood Marshall Academy is an oasis. Despite everything working against them, students there have managed to post 95% attendance rates, along with the third highest test scores of any D.C. high school with open enrollment. But the most impressive stat of all is that every single member of the school's first four classes, it opened in 2002, went on to college. As schools like TMA prosper, public schools will bear the consequences for their years of futility. So what happens to the schools that aren't chosen by many parents? Really bad ones might die. Oh my gosh. The F word, failure. I hope we at least write their eviction order in purple ink. Others might lose students, but parents will eventually recognize that smaller classes are a positive, perhaps leading to a resurgence. But there's an even bigger benefit that would play out over time. Because schools would no longer be monopolies, they'd find themselves competing for dollars with other schools. That means they would actually have to try to earn your business and attract students with incentives like having better teachers, more extracurricular options, and cleaner, high-tech classrooms. Competition is good. Imagine that. Maybe the best reason of all to support school choice is that those entrenched firmly on the side of the status quo, like the teachers' unions, government bureaucrats, and politicians, are so strongly against it.
Gee, why are you always picking on teachers' unions? Our teachers are public servants who devote their careers to helping kids.
We have no argument there, but a classic idiot's technique is to confuse the debate. Teachers are completely different from teachers' unions, just as auto assembly line workers are completely different from the United Auto Workers Union. People are people, but unions, generally speaking, are about power and control. Unions may have been founded with a grand purpose, but most are now big, bloated, self-serving bureaucracies with huge budgets and largely left-wing agendas fueled more by politics than a sense of duty to their members. Teachers' unions are no different, but instead of making bad cars more expensive, creating mounds of needless paperwork, or shutting down the subway system in a strike, they work hard to damage your children's futures. Maybe the children themselves should have a union. In his book, The War Against Hope, former Education Secretary Rod Page accuses teachers' unions of having maximum power over the schools with minimal accountability for their failure. He believes they're resistant to change and willing to fight tooth and nail to retain the status quo and enforce policies that are detrimental to students. If Al Gore had any idea how much paper is wasted in keeping our students from learning, he'd cry us a new ocean. In 2005, the New York City teacher's contract was 204 pages long, with another 105-page memorandum of understanding tacked on for good measure. What could possibly be contained in so many sheets of pulp tree? Rules. Primarily, rules that protect union members in almost any circumstance you can imagine, and lots that you can't. Trying to fire a bad teacher is, in many districts, like trying to get a cow to walk downstairs. It's just not going to happen. In fact, school administrators know it's such an uphill battle that they're often not inclined to even try. The L.A. Unified School District currently has 30,000 tenured teachers, yet they manage to fire just 21 a year. The ones who are eventually terminated are the worst of the worst, because the ones who didn't get fired include a teacher who kept pornography, cocaine vials, and marijuana at school, and one who was so unable to teach or control her class that students were actually getting injured in it. Bad teachers, like bad priests, are simply shuffled through the system so that the damage they do is spread out. But aside from being unable to get rid of the worst teachers, unions also prevent the best teachers from being rewarded. Salaries aren't based on merit, but on longevity. Good and bad teachers are paid the same, another remnant of that tiresome we're all equal mentality from the progressive era.
ADD moment. Ah, I wish I could have seen the faces of the teachers' union lobbyists when they heard Obama say, "I reject the system that rewards failure and protects a person from its consequences." Oops. I wonder if they all want their money back now.
Private schools aren't beholden to unions, but they should be closed because they're only for the rich.
I will never agree with the premise that just because someone can't afford something, it's not good or fair. Frankly, that sounds a little socialist. A lot of people can't afford a Mercedes S-Class sedan, but that doesn't mean Mercedes should be forced to stop making them. No, people generally accept the fact that in order to buy a car like that, they'll need to have more money. That gives them a little something that we capitalists like to call incentive. Second, most schools offer financial aid to students who qualify for it. That defeats the only for the rich argument, as would a voucher program. Do families still have to make sacrifices? Absolutely. But what better way to have parents invested in the success of their children than to have parents literally invested in the success of their children?
Oh, I suppose you're going to say the best way to have parents invested is to have them homeschool their kids. Let me tell you something. Homeschool kids, they don't learn as much. They're dummies. Okay? And they also suffer socially. Jerk face.
Opponents of homeschooling spend a lot of time trying to convince people that those who take education into their own hands create ignorant social misfits. In their opinion, there's nothing worse than a child spending several hours a day learning at the hands of, shudder, his or her own parents. They also assume that at the conclusion of the school day, the child is confined to a small windowless space before being sent off to bed. The end result is obviously a socially maladjusted freak who winds up living in his mom's basement or shuffling around the neighborhood in fuzzy pajamas. Of course, the reality is that homeschooled children are like any other children. The only difference is that they get focused instruction in a more comfortable environment from an individual who knows, understands, and loves them. Perish the thought. There's nothing that prevents homeschooled kids from socializing with peers, playing in Little League or herd ball, otherwise known as soccer, going to the movies, hanging out at the park, enrolling in summer camp, etc., etc.
ADD moment. If homeschooling is such a terrible idea, then why has the national homeschooling rate increased 74% in just 8 years? Well, here are the top reasons given by parents. Do any of them resonate with you? For instance, concern over the school environment? No. Desire to provide moral and religious instruction? God, what? Dissatisfaction with academic instruction at schools? No.
But even if the homeschooled kids don't go drink warm beer in the alley with the public schoolers, they still develop fine. In a 2000 study, homeschooled and public-private school children played among themselves under direct supervision. If you expected the homeschooled kids to have spent their time hidden under the table crying for their mommies, you're going to be disappointed. All of the kids played together. Or, in the words of the report, there is no basis to question the social development of homeschooled children. If homeschooled kids develop just fine socially, then the only plausible argument left against homeschooling is that they aren't getting a proper education. Given the disaster in our public schools, that's a pretty dumb argument, but let's look at the data anyway. An independent study of over 5,000 homeschooled students showed that they outperformed public school students by 30 to 37 percentile points in all subjects. Another study of over 5,000 homeschooled children showed that they scored 18 to 28 percentile points above public school averages on the Stanford Achievement Test, one of the leading standardized tests used by schools. I'm not saying that all parents would make great teachers or that homeschooling is for everyone, but I am saying that the stigma of socially awkward kids with a below-average education is a complete fabrication. Besides, just as with school vouchers, whenever the entrenched powers that be are so wildly against something, I tend to think it probably deserves another look.
At least we have the No Child Left Behind Act to level the playing field and narrow class and racial performance gaps.
As with many well-intentioned government programs, No Child Left Behind, NCLB, ultimately fails because it doesn't level the playing field. It lowers the bar. And lowering the bar is one reason why people can't spell words anymore. Let's call it a don't ask, don't tell policy for the stupid. Here's a quick history lesson, especially for you homeschooled kids, since I know you never learned this stuff. Prisoners in Stalin's forced labor camps were assigned production quotas. Instead of trying to meet them, which was basically impossible, they lied, cheated, and manipulated. It turns out that fear of death is a pretty good motivator. Authorities all the way up the chain of command turned a blind eye because, in the end, what was more important than tangible results was simply reporting to Stalin that results had been achieved. It was better to claim you cleared an acre of forest than to have actually cleared an acre of forest. Of course, that was one of the reasons why forced labor in the Soviet Union failed, leading to the failure of the Soviet Union itself. No Child Left Behind works in very much the same way. By setting a timetable with unattainable goals and threatening schools and teachers if they fail to achieve them, they're incentivizing everyone to game the system, and they do. One of the main criticisms of NCLB is that it motivates schools to deny children a broad education and instead focus their entire curriculum on teaching to the test. In other words, they don't worry about teaching kids useful things, like, for example, what a progressive really stands for, because they're never asked that question on a standardized test. Another way to game the system is by outright cheating. NCLB has the dubious distinction of actually turning the teacher into the cheater in the classroom. To improve overall scores, teachers have been caught asking weak students to stay home on test days, offering help in solving problems, fixing wrong answers after the test is over, and allowing extra time to finish. Cheating is so prevalent that economist Stephen D. Levitt, author of Freakonomics, developed an algorithm with a colleague to spot it. The result? They discovered even more cheating than they originally thought. But oftentimes, you don't even need an algorithm, you just need common sense. If one year a school has a pitiful ranking and the next year it's a miraculous success, something fishy is probably going on. It's like steroids in baseball. A guy doesn't go from hitting 12 home runs in a year to 40 the next without a little outside help. Yet because the powers that be feel the ends justify the means, no one cracks down before it's too late. And with our schools, it's already way too late. Unfortunately, NCLB scams aren't just confined to individual schools. States, eager to report to Uncle Stalin just how great things are going, happily carry it on. In 2004, the number of failing schools in Michigan went from 1,500 to 216. A remarkable achievement, until you discover that all the state did was lower the passing score from 75 to 42. Who is the big loser in this scam? Our kids, of course. And who is the biggest winner? The politicians and unions that can cash faux test scores in for heaps of federal cash. What a great system.
The real problem isn't with NCLB. It's with teacher pay. You get what you pay for.
It's true. Being a teacher does not pay as well as being a CEO who runs his company into the ground before bailing out of the corporate jet in a golden parachute. But being a teacher doesn't pay that poorly either. The 2008 Bureau of Labor Statistics study puts the average middle school teacher's annual salary at $52,570. Compare that to policemen at $52,480 or short order cooks at $20,230. Then remember that teachers have a shorter workday, longer vacations, and public sector health and retirement benefits that are often better than those of workers in the private sector. The problem is not that teachers don't get paid well, although you'll never hear me arguing against higher pay for teachers who deserve it. It's that their pay is based on longevity, not performance. When you don't reward someone for being good at his or her job, the incentive to be extraordinary is diminished. In fact, the incentive to be mediocre is increased because teachers who stand out are liable to rock the boat. But good teachers aren't penalized with antiquated concepts like tenure because the man is trying to keep our kids dumb. They're not paid more because of the unions. By trying to protect all jobs, unions are actually helping their worst performing members while hurting their best. Tenure was originally introduced for college professors in 1910 as a way to protect their academic pursuits and research. And when you think about it in those terms, it kind of makes sense. You want professors to be able to speak their mind, conduct research, and creatively teach controversial subjects without fear of losing their job. In the 1920s, as women fought for the right to vote, tenure was extended to K-12 teachers, even as the requirements for obtaining it were becoming far easier to achieve. College professors still needed to publish papers and were subject to up to a decade of probation, but grade school teachers, not so much. In California, it now takes as little as just 2 years for a teacher to get tenure. 2 years, and then you can basically sit back, relax, and not worry about being fired for the rest of your life. Can you think of any good reason why a K-12 teacher should have tenure? I can't, but the teachers' unions sure can. Governor Schwarzenegger's efforts to try and make tenure rules even slightly more reasonable were met with such fierce resistance that you'd have thought he was asking everyone to give up their Priuses.
Well, it doesn't matter what changes you make because the system will always favor upscale white folks. Honky.
If the system favors upscale white folks, it's because of the changes that aren't being made. It's because the schools fail our children time and again, and nothing is ever done. It's because voucher programs that would take poor kids out of lousy, dangerous schools are being denied. The system shouldn't favor anyone, and doesn't have to, but instead, it's failing everyone. The big A-plus answer, assuming, of course, that you're at a school that still allows tests, is to break the cycle of poverty with a cycle of achievement. But we'll never do that with tenure, unions, politicians, bureaucrats, and special interest groups all standing in the way. And blaming the man for those failings is a cop-out. Suggesting that minorities from traditionally poorer socioeconomic backgrounds can't be on par with white peers is nonsense. Asian immigrants, hailing from backgrounds equally as poor as their Hispanic and black counterparts, routinely pummel white students in the SATs. How can that be? Shouldn't they be horribly stifled and at a tremendous disadvantage because of the fact that they're minorities? And for many of them, English isn't even spoken at home. Absolutely, which just goes to show that scores, stats, and studies tell only part of the story. People can twist data to lead you to whatever conclusion is in their best interest. But one thing can't be twisted because it's indisputable. Our selfish unwillingness to put aside our ideological differences and stop playing politics with education will unquestionably lead not only to the failing of our children, but ultimately to the failing of America as well.
Chapter 4. America's Energy Future. Cars, corn, carbon, and controversy. Is there anything that makes a case for curbing government influence better than the energy issue? The decades pass, the presidents come and go, but one thing remains the same. America's appetite for oil is far bigger than her stomach. Our energy crisis is stealthy, like termites slowly destroying a house from the inside. Unfortunately, we're about to step through one of the decaying floorboards. 2008's skyrocketing oil prices showed us just how vulnerable we are. But lost in the shock over $4 gas was what caused the crisis. Nothing. There was no Arab oil embargo, no Middle East war, no massive destruction of refineries from hurricanes or earthquakes, just a marketplace, realizing that demand was increasing dramatically while supply was slowly but inevitably running out. We've been told for years that the answer to our problems lies in green energy. Unfortunately, the facts tell a different story. In 1981, renewable energy was responsible for about 7% of America's total energy use. After 27 years of broken promises and billions of dollars poured into developing alternative technologies, renewable energy now accounts for a whopping 6.7% of our total. Whoa, that is quite an achievement. If green energy is as good, cheap, and clean as supporters say it is, then market forces should automatically be making it a growing part of the equation. Instead, the opposite is happening. Why? One reason might be that many of the green lobby's leaders are not as interested in promoting new sources of energy as they are in getting rid of old ones. While this movement may have started with good intentions, it's now been hijacked by those who see it as a vehicle to drive us back to the Stone Age or, at a minimum, to move us closer to government ownership and control of our energy supply. The effort by those who use green energy to further their real agenda is sometimes called the watermelon effect. It's a green rind of pro-environment policies, hiding a core of wealth redistribution policies that are as red as Marx's blood. This charade only prolongs America's oil addiction and keeps us slaves to nasty foreign governments. We imported just over a third of our oil in 1981. We import 70% now. Unfortunately, that seems to be exactly what some people want. After all, the less control we have over our own energy supply, the more control others have over us. So instead of constructively looking for new solutions, you'll often hear people launch now familiar attacks using idiotic arguments like,
"Big oil intentionally drives oil prices higher so they can line the pockets of their greedy executives."
Okay, first, let's acknowledge the obvious. Big oil made a lot of money in 2008. Exxon made a $45.2 billion profit, shattering the record for profit by a U.S. company, a record they set themselves just a year earlier. Go capitalism! Chevron also set a company record with a $23.9 billion profit. Saying the oil industry had a good year in 2008 is like saying that Babe Ruth was a decent hitter. It wasn't a good year, it was a historic year. So why are people so angry? On the surface, sure, those profits sound big. Okay, they sound massive. Okay, they are massive, but so what? Are we really a country that no longer celebrates legitimate success stories or admires profits won on the battlefield of the free market? Not surprisingly, the green lobby has been quick to latch on to this red herring. They paint the oil industry as an evil cabal that meets in shadowy, cigar smoke-filled back rooms, scheming ways to jack up gas prices and hoodwink the average American family. But when you look deeper into the issue and examine pesky little things like numbers, facts, and economic principles, it becomes much less nefarious. From 1986 to 2006, the average price of crude was $25.95 per barrel. In 2007, the average price skyrocketed to $72.30, and in July 2008, oil hit an all-time high of $147.27 per barrel. Higher oil prices result in higher oil profits. If that's sinister, then so is every other principle taught in Economics 101. Now, maybe you still believe that the oil companies are evil because they drove the price up to line their own pockets. Maybe some oil council of doom, consisting of mustachioed tycoons, sat in a smoky boardroom and spun a wheel that landed on $150 a barrel. If that's what you think, I probably can't help you. But if you're rational, you probably already understand what really happened. Prices rose because of a rise in global demand. China, India, and other developing nations are emerging as huge economies that require massive amounts of oil to operate. Brazil's oil consumption increased 7% from 2006 to 2007. China's consumption increased by 12%. And India's appetite for oil has increased 27 straight years, from 643,000 barrels per day in 1980 to 2.72 million a day in 2007. As the global demand for oil spiked like never before, prices also spiked like never before. So unless you're against the world developing, it's hard to be against the rise in oil prices. Once prices are high, and let's be careful, high is a relative term, we may look back at $150 a barrel as a bargain, oil companies, which have a responsibility to their shareholders, naturally want to sell more of their product. Why would they restrict supply in times when demand is highest? That would be like shutting down your ice cream shop for the summer. From 1986 to 2006, the average global output of oil was about 72.4 million barrels a day. The most recent numbers show that the global average increased to 84.8 million barrels per day in 2007, an increase of over 17%. When profit potential is higher, businesses produce more. That's the way a free market works.
ADD moment. Profit potential is also why you see a company like Apple cranking out product after product right now. They're not doing it because they love working 100-hour weeks. They're doing it because their products are in high demand, and they see an opportunity to grab huge profits.
No, 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 no! The way a free market works is that big oil is able to make obscene profits off the backs of hard-working Americans.
Even after my stirring defense of supply and demand, you still want to focus on that giant profit number, don't you? Fine, but those profits are meaningless unless you compare them to profit rates of other big companies. Exxon and Chevron each have a profit margin of roughly 9%. That's less than Microsoft, Apple, Google, Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola, Nike, and many other beloved American corporations. Crazy, but you never hear outrage directed at those evil, no-tier shampoo-peddling tyrants from Johnson & Johnson or those nefarious techno-hippies at Apple. Here's another way to look at it. In 2007, the oil industry made just 9 cents in profit for every dollar of revenue. The average for companies in the S&P 500 index was 13 cents, meaning oil companies made less money per dollar of revenue than the average large U.S. public company. I understand that an evil, greedy conservative defending the profits of the evil, greedy oil companies isn't all that compelling, so let me try a different angle. Not only is big oil not trying to screw over average American families, they are actively helping them. And not just because they do the work that allows us all to get to work. Take ExxonMobil, for instance. It's easy to drag their executives in front of Congress for their annual tongue-lashing, but those guys own less than 1% of the company. The vast majority of ExxonMobil is owned by people like you and me. Mutual funds, 401ks, and pension funds account for about 52% of Exxon's shares. The rest is owned by about 2 million individual investors, regular Americans looking to better their lives by investing in growing companies. If Exxon is evil, then I guess that means all of the senior citizens who pay for their prescription drugs and utility bills with profits from Exxon-invested pensions are evil too. But oil profits don't just enrich investors. They enrich our government also. While giant corporations freefall, only to be saved by billion-dollar taxpayer parachutes, big oil is paying the government hundreds of billions of dollars in taxes. In other words, big oil is giving money directly back to the people, instead of stealing it from them, which other corporations find so trendy these days. In 2006, the oil industry paid $81 billion in income taxes. If you look at Exxon alone, you find that from 2003 to 2007, their earnings increased by 89%, while their income taxes skyrocketed 170%. Over the three-year period from 2006 to 2008, Exxon paid a total of $94.2 billion, an amount approximately equal to the annual GDP of Ecuador and Guatemala combined. But that's just their income tax. ExxonMobil's total taxes in 2008 reached $116.2 billion, more than twice its net profit. That's about $318 million in taxes per day. If anyone is benefiting from these so-called windfall profits, it's our government.
Good! It's their patriotic duty to pay more taxes so the government can help those who are less fortunate.
Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner once said that additional taxes on oil companies could be absorbed because they are so small compared to their large revenues. Last year, Senator Dick Durbin, an Illinois Democrat, went a step further, saying oil companies need to know that there's a limit on how much profit they can take in this economy. Using the tax code as a weapon, caps on profits, Karl Marx would be proud. President Obama has backed off his promise to institute a windfall profits tax, but it's not like he's suddenly turned into a Texas oil man. He still intends to rake in an additional $31.5 billion from the oil sector by raising royalty rates and implementing new taxes. The budget he proposed in early 2009 would levy a 13% tax on oil and gas from the Gulf of Mexico, raising about $5 billion over the next decade. He would also institute a fee on energy leases in the Gulf that are non-producing, also known as exploratory. That fee would raise another $1.2 billion over the coming decade. While all of that may sound appetizing to those of us who don't go oil drilling on weekends, two things happen when you raise taxes on oil companies. Neither of them good. First, capital moves to more favorable tax environments, meaning that U.S. companies will flock to foreign sources of oil to get cheaper prices. Second, taxing an activity discourages people from doing it. Of course, the inverse is also true, which is why so many states have occasional tax holidays to promote spending. The tax on Gulf oil is essentially an oil sin tax that will lead companies to produce less oil from that region. That, in turn, will reduce supply, which will inevitably cause prices to rise, thereby bringing the incredible chest-puffing politicians out of hibernation once again. Obama has also proposed raising revenue through a carbon emission cap-and-trade system that would force companies to buy permits allowing them to pollute. This program would pull in an estimated $112 billion by 2012 and would generate $50 to $300 billion a year by 2020. As a side benefit, it would also essentially redistribute the wealth of our most productive companies to the least productive bureaucracy in the world, our government, and eventually to governments of developing countries around the globe. It doesn't take a degree in economics to understand that hundreds of billions of new tax dollars have to come from somewhere. In this case, they'll come from higher prices on all kinds of products and services, something that will be terrible for the economy, not to mention those working families we always hear about in the stump speeches. The real reason this program is called cap and trade is that it puts a cap on success and trades prosperity for poverty. By penalizing companies for simply operating and producing, cap-and-trade schemes will reduce manufacturing output. Pro, fewer emissions. Con, fewer jobs. And that, in turn, will reduce America's GDP. Pro, lower carbon output. Con, lower standard of living.
So, not only do you not want to penalize oil companies, you actually want to help them make even more money by letting them slaughter innocent polar bears and Arctic seals.
It's a paradox that those who want to keep Alaska off limits will never admit to. But the more we're prevented from tapping our own oil resources, the more the environment is put at risk. When we can't produce enough oil, we import it. The countries we import it from have to explore and drill to meet our needs. Countries like Venezuela, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. Those are countries that barely care about people. So how much do you really think they worry about herding green alligators and long-necked geese, some humpty-backed camels, or some chimpanzees?
ADD moment. If you realize that that list of animals is actually from a popular Irish drinking song, then you're either A, an alcoholic,
hello brother, keep working the program,
B, a recovering alcoholic,
hello, brother, welcome back.
Or C, friendless. Considering that I actually use those lyrics in this book, I'd have to say I'm both B and C.
Most people think about green energy as a replacement for oil. While that may very well be, it's a long way off. Instead of thinking about solar, wind, and hydro replacing oil, start thinking about those alternative sources supplementing oil. If we can gradually increase our reliance on clean sources of energy that are both economical and efficient, then believe me, the free markets will do the rest. Our reliance